The Federal News Update for Monday, December 22, 2025.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today we are unpacking what has to be one of the most consequential synchronized days of action from the U.S. federal government that we have seen in a very long time.
We're looking at Friday, December 19, 2025. I mean, it was a single day that was just an undeniable demonstration of executive power really projected across, well, everywhere. The White House, DOJ, the Supreme Court, DOT, even Congress.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. My job today is really to connect those dots. Because December 19th, it wasn't just a bunch of unrelated headlines.
No, not at all.
It was a carefully choreographed use of governmental power. We saw trade authority being used for domestic health policy, a really hard line drawn on border sovereignty, and then, you know, that constant deliberate friction between the executive and everyone else.
The judiciary, Congress, you name it.
We're going to give you the granular detail, the critical context you really need to understand what feels like a major inflection point.
And that's our mission for you, the learner. We want to give you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed on this really pivotal day. We've synthesized a huge stack of source material. I mean, everything from complex court filings to internal memos. And we're going to cover four defining spheres of action.
That's right. And these four spheres, they really define the entire day. First, you've got this historic expansion of the Trump RX drug pricing initiative.
Yeah.
And it was secured entirely through this really innovative use of executive trade authority, the whole most favored nation or MFN pricing thing.
Okay.
Second, we're going to dive into the Department of Transportation's really aggressive enforcement of English language standards for cross-border rail crews. It fundamentally changes how major infrastructure operates.
And then third, and this one was huge, we have to dissect the immensely controversial and heavily redacted release of documents from the Jeffrey Epstein investigation.
A disclosure that, I mean, it instantly fueled accusations of political manipulation, of censorship.
And finally, the fourth major story, a key procedural defeat for the administration at the Supreme Court, the Margolin case, which has these profound implications for the political independence of the entire federal civil service.
It's an almost unbelievable amount of high-stakes action.
Right.
Especially for a Friday, you know, right before the holidays. It just paints this very clear picture of an administration maximizing every ounce of its strategic authority.
Right.
Right up until the last minute.
Okay, let's unpack this right away. Let's start with that first and probably most immediate domestic action, the reshaping of the pharmaceutical market. This historic expansion of Trump RX. It uses tools we normally think of for, you know, global trade fights, not for healthcare here at home.
Yeah.
What exactly does this paradigm shift look like, and who are the giants they brought into the fold?
Well, the list of companies is what makes it so historic. I mean, this wasn't just one agency. This was a whole of government negotiation.
Yeah.
You had the White House coordinating directly with the U.S. Trade Representative,
Big.
And they secured agreements from nine new pharmaceutical heavyweights all at once. We're talking Amgen, Bristol Myers Squibb, Boehringer Ingelheim, Genentech, Gilead Sciences, GSK, Merck, Novartis, and Sanofi.
Wow. That is a huge slice of the global drug market.
It is. These companies represent a massive cross-section of global drug manufacturing.
So nine giants signing on in a single day, that's a powerful political statement. But I want to slow down on the mechanism. MFN pricing, I mean, that's usually about trade parity between countries, right? How do you translate that into forcing drug price cuts here in the U.S.?
And that's where the real innovation is. MFN pricing, as they've applied it here, dictates that for certain drugs sold to specific U.S. government programs, Medicaid is the big one.
Okay, Medicaid.
And this is the crucial part. To cash-paying consumers, the price has to be capped. And that cap isn't just some arbitrary number. It's tied directly to the lowest price that's offered for that exact same drug to any other developed nation in the OECD.
So just to make sure I'm getting this, if a country like, say, Germany or Japan, who are known for having really strong national price controls, if they negotiate a price for a big cancer drug that's 60% lower than the U.S. list price,
then the U.S. consumer using this new system should, in theory, see that same 60% reduction.
That is a direct assault on the old model.
It's the explicit goal. It's a direct attack on that long-standing economic model where, you know, U.S. consumers have effectively subsidized global pharma R&D with these superinflated list prices. The MFN mechanism just forces parity with those other markets. It overturns decades of how the industry has operated here.
But that sounds like the kind of fundamental policy change that should require a massive legislative battle, probably amending the Social Security Act or something. How did they pull this off unilaterally without a single new law? What was the leverage? I mean, what was so strong it could force 9 global companies to just fall in line?
The leverage was pure trade authority, and it was used as a coercive tool, a big stick. The administration threatened severe, immediate tariffs. They specifically threatened to slap import duties on these companies' products under 2 really powerful trade statutes. Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, which deals with national security,
Social Security,
and Section 301, which covers unfair foreign trade practices.
So they basically reinterpreted high drug prices as a kind of unfair trade practice. Or maybe they framed the price gap as a national security risk because of our supply chain reliance.
Precisely. By defining the problem in those terms, using those specific statutes, it made the tariff threat real, immediate, and credible. And the quid pro quo was, you know, incredibly advantageous for the administration. The 9 companies got a critical 3-year exemption from these looming duties.
And in exchange?
In exchange, they agreed to adopt MFN pricing and participate in the new platform. It's a strategy that completely bypasses Congress. It creates a, you know, a de facto regulatory system through private bilateral negotiation. They're just monetizing access to the huge U.S. market.
I mean, it's undeniably effective, but it does raise some serious questions about precedent. If you use national security or unfair trade authority for a purely domestic price control, doesn't that set a really volatile precedent for future administrations?
Absolutely.
They could just apply tariffs to achieve any domestic goal they want, whether it's, you know, environmental standards or labor rules.
And that is the core constitutional and economic risk that critics are flagging. They argue the executive is blurring the lines between foreign policy, which is trade, and domestic regulation, which is health care. I mean, if the president can use the threat of a 25% tariff to force a price cut on a cancer drug today, what stops a future president from threatening tariffs on, say, domestic steel producers tomorrow to force a certain wage structure?
It's a powerful tool.
It's a powerful executive innovation, but it carries these really deep risks to the separation of powers and just stable trade relations in general.
So let's shift to the operational side. How is the government making sure that you, the consumer, actually see these benefits? Where do these negotiated drugs actually get sold?
And this is where the administration tries to just fundamentally restructure the supply chain. They set up and detailed the role of TrumpRx.gov.
Okay.
You should think of it as a government-run unified storefront. Patients can go there, purchase these medications directly from the manufacturer at the negotiated MFN rates, and completely bypass the traditional messy distribution layers.
And the strategic target here, it seems to go beyond just the manufacturers. It feels like it's aimed right at the middle layers of the system. I'm talking about the pharmacy benefit managers, the PBMs.
Oh, without a doubt. The administration has been relentless in calling PBMs rent seekers, to use an analogy. If the drug is a concert ticket, the manufacturer is the venue, and the patient is the fan.
Right.
The PBMs are seen as the ticket scalpers. They use these opaque, really complex rebate systems to take a cut, and they often drive up the final cost without adding any real value for the patient.
So TrumpRx.gov is the direct-to-consumer channel.
Exactly. By creating this direct low-cost channel, the government is forcing PBMs to compete directly with this new alternative. If they can't justify their markup against the government's low guaranteed price, well, their whole business model is threatened.
And the implication for the PBMs and also for the manufacturers who didn't sign on to this platform must be huge. Is this an existential threat for them?
It is. I mean, the manufacturers who haven't signed on are now forced to compete with a government-backed option, selling products from 9 of their biggest rivals at steep international discounts. And on top of that, because MFN pricing applies to Medicaid sales, all manufacturers selling to Medicaid will feel that pressure.
So PBMs will have a hard time justifying a more expensive drug.
Exactly. If a PBM tries to push a higher-priced alternative, both the patients who can just go to TrumpRx.gov and SDS and the state Medicaid systems now have this powerfully discounted public option to benchmark against. It's an immediate major disruption to the entire economic balance of the pharma sector.
Let's get more concrete on the public health benefits. What's the therapeutic scope here? Where are we going to see the biggest cuts?
They're hitting the most expensive and the highest demand areas. So metabolic disorders, that's type 2 diabetes, and crucially, those extremely popular GLP-1 agonists that are used for obesity and weight management.
The ones that are everywhere right now.
Exactly. It also covers critical high-cost therapies in oncology, immunology for things like MS and rheumatoid arthritis, and infectious disease treatments, including those for HIV and hepatitis B and C.
Can you give us a specific, memorable example of the kind of impact we're talking about?
Yeah, Merck's commitment on their diabetes drugs, Januvia and Janumet, is a perfect illustration. They committed to dropping the price for cash-paying consumers on the TrumpRx platform by roughly 70% off the current list price.
70%? That is not a marginal discount.
No, it's transformative for anyone who's uninsured or underinsured trying to manage a chronic disease. And it follows the precedent set by that earlier Novo Nordisk deal for Wegovy, where we saw prices drop from over $1,300 to about $350. It was a monumental change in access for obesity treatment.
And before we move on, let's just circle back to that national security component you mentioned. It sounds like the administration used the urgency of the API crisis to sort of sweeten the deal politically.
Oh, they did. The strategic layering here is superb. As part of these agreements, GSK, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Merck all committed to donating active pharmaceutical ingredients, or APIs.
The raw ingredients for the drugs.
Right, the core ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
For critical medicines like certain antibiotics and blood thinners, they'll donate them directly to the Strategic Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Reserve. This is a very deliberate, proactive step to reduce U.S. reliance on foreign supply chains, especially those in China and India, which are so vulnerable to geopolitical tension.
So by integrating health security into a trade deal, it validates their use of that Section 232, the National Security Authority.
It's the perfect justification.
That is a truly comprehensive look at the Trump-Arcaris expansion. You have a powerful executive using global economic levers for populist domestic goals.
Okay, let's pivot sharply. From economic nationalism in healthcare to nationalism in infrastructure and safety, what was going on at the same time at the Department of Transportation?
Well, while the White House was hammering out these economic deals, the Department of Transportation, under Secretary Sean Duffy, was executing a major regulatory crackdown on cross-border rail. And this move was explicitly framed as enforcing American sovereignty and crucial safety standards on the rail infrastructure we share with Mexico.
What was the specific operational directive from the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA? The core action was the strict, non-negotiable enforcement of English language proficiency requirements for all train crews operating inside U.S. territory. And this was targeted squarely at the major Class I railroads, Union Pacific and Canadian Pacific Kansas City, which rely so heavily on that cross-border traffic.
So what are the actual consequences? What happens to a Mexican crew that crosses the border if they don't have full FRA certification in English?
They face immediate hard restrictions. The directive prohibits any non-certified Mexican crews from operating a train more than 10 miles beyond the U.S. border.
Just 10 miles. That is a hard line.
It's a very hard line. And that 10-mile allowance is just a narrow geographical exception. It's only there to let the train get to the nearest pre-designated inspection and crew change point. The operational mandate is a mandatory crew swap right at that location. They have to be immediately relieved by a U.S. certified crew.
That has to significantly disrupt the logistics for these huge railroads. They'd have to completely change how they staff their border routes. What about communication inside that short, critical 10-mile zone?
Well, the railroads are now mandated to use certified interpreters for any essential communication within that 10-mile zone if the crew doesn't have the required proficiency.
Which is a costly and time-consuming burden.
Absolutely. It's an administrative burden imposed directly on the railroads, and it signals that the DOT is dead serious about strict enforcement.
So the DOT's justification for this was primarily about safety risk. What specific data or imperatives did Secretary Duffy cite to legitimize what seems like a pretty disruptive action?
The administration really hammered the safety narrative. Secretary Duffy used this compelling visual, saying that operating an 80-ton big rig or a massive freight train requires English proficiency because any breakdown in communication creates an unacceptable safety risk.
And their point is that U.S. dispatchers, emergency crews, they all operate in English.
Right. And they backed it up with specifics. FRA inspection findings from late 2025 revealed what they called serious safety concerns. They had documented instances of foreign crews failing to correctly interpret general track bulletins. And these are real-time critical updates on track conditions or hazards.
And what about hazardous materials? That seems like the biggest risk.
It is. And they cited failures to communicate effectively with English-speaking dispatchers and, most critically, the inability to read or interpret hazardous materials documentation. I mean, in the event of a catastrophic derailment, and we've certainly seen some high-profile ones recently, that communication failure is a profound liability risk, especially when you're trying to coordinate with local English-speaking first responders.
While that safety imperative is very real, isn't the 10-mile restriction inherently political? I mean, couldn't this just be seen as an end run around labor negotiations or really just a strategic win for U.S. unions more than a sudden safety push? The timing feels very coordinated.
And that is the necessary counter-narrative, and it's a strong one. This action is a massive, deliberate political victory for U.S. rail unions, specifically the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, the BLET and the Teamsters.
Right.
These unions have been aggressively lobbying the White House to restrict the use of Mexican crews, citing both job displacement for U.S. workers and, you know, border security concerns. For the unions, this is protectionism dressed up as safety.
So the administration's America First labor policy meets the union's protectionist interests, and they find this powerful common ground on national sovereignty and critical infrastructure. It has to solidify their political support among blue-collar workers.
Exactly. The Teamsters publicly call this a significant regulatory win. It's a strategic use of administrative enforcement to lock down a key political base by giving them a tangible, deliverable, restricting foreign labor on U.S. tracks. It shows that the administration will aggressively use these regulatory tools to achieve cultural, labor, and security goals all at the same time.
And this action on the rail lines, it wasn't an isolated incident when it comes to enforcing language standards, was it? This seems to fit a much wider DOT strategy.
It absolutely does. Secretary Duffy himself connected this rail crackdown to the wider administrative goal of enforcing strict federal linguistic and safety standards across all transportation. And he'd already used similar leverage with California, which is a really significant data point here.
Remind us of the California example. What did the DOT do there?
The DOT withheld a massive $40 million in federal highway funds from the state of California.
Wow.
And the reason was that the state was judged to be failing to adequately enforce the required English proficiency standards for commercial driver's licenses, CDLs, that were being issued to immigrants.
Withholding $40 million isn't a warning shot. That's a punitive action.
It establishes a clear, undeniable pattern. Transportation funding and regulatory approval are being explicitly weaponized to enforce federal linguistic standards. And this ties administrative law, like the rules for CDLs and freight rail, directly to broader cultural and national security goals. It creates this potent lever that extends way beyond the traditional definitions of just transportation safety.
Okay, so we've covered two massive synchronized executive actions. One, economic, using trade policy, and one regulatory, using safety concerns. Let's shift gears now to that fraught intersection between the executive and judicial branches, and specifically the DOJ's highly anticipated but, well, highly controversial document release, the Epstein files.
This was the moment where the executive branch had to respond to a legislative mandate. The DOJ was compelled to release documents under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which Congress had just passed last month. The release started on the evening of December 19th, and, I mean, it instantly generated intense political heat.
So what was actually in this first batch of documents that the DOJ released?
The initial release was thousands of pages of archival material. You had grand jury testimony, FBI interview transcripts, and, very notably, physical evidence like photographs that were confiscated from Jeffrey Epstein's properties. And this confirmed the sheer extent of Epstein's social network.
And who were the specific high-profile figures named or pictured in this release that got the most immediate attention?
The documents confirm the association of several major international figures. Photographs were released showing former President Bill Clinton socializing with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, including some specific images of them in a swimming pool environment.
Right.
Other prominent names identified in the documents or photos included Prince Andrew, the late musician Michael Jackson, the comedian Chris Tucker, and the entrepreneur Richard Branson. The collection really spanned global royalty, high finance, entertainment, and politics.
Given the intense partisan environment, the question immediately turns to the president himself. How did these files address his relationship with Epstein?
So the release did contain a small number of photographs that featured President Trump. However, administration sources, people familiar with the whole preparation and redaction process, they provided a really crucial detail. They said that while the president's name appeared multiple times throughout the entire universe of files the DOJ has,
right,
Fewer documents that directly implicated him in compromising activity were included in this specific Friday release compared to other political figures, like former President Clinton.
And that detail immediately sets the stage for the core controversy here, which is about opacity, redaction, and accusations of censorship. What was the biggest criticism leveled at the DOJ's execution of this release?
The immediate reaction from the media and from transparency advocates was just one of outrage. Outrage over the opacity and the sheer scale of the redaction. CBS News, in its initial analysis, reported that a minimum of 550 pages of the disclosure were entirely blacked out.
A full-page redaction.
Yes, completely blacked out. And that scale of masking immediately triggered accusations that the DOJ was deliberately obscuring crucial and perhaps politically sensitive information.
And the censorship accusation was only fueled by the disappearance of specific files, wasn't it?
That's right. The controversy deepened dramatically when specific files, the ones that reportedly contained images of President Trump, just vanished from the DOJ website shortly after they were initially uploaded. Now, whether that was accidental or deliberate, the act of them disappearing provided potent ammunition for critics claiming active manipulation of the public record by the executive branch.
How did Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche defend the DOJ's handling of this massive, incredibly sensitive information dump?
Blanche defended the heavy redactions by citing the sheer, almost unmanageable volume of material that they had to review. He pointed specifically to the legal necessity of protecting the privacy and sensitive identities of victims and any uncharged third parties who were mentioned in the files. His key operational defense was that the documents would be released on a rolling basis over the following weeks. But that strategy, while you can defend it logistically, is politically fraught. It means the executive branch keeps control over the pacing and the sequencing of all the damaging revelations. They get to manage the news cycle over time.
So the political fallout was immediate. How did congressional Democrats, who were the ones who mandated this release, how did they react to this selective disclosure?
Well, congressional Democrats, led by Representative Ro Khanna, were immediate and aggressive. They charged that the administration had violated the Epstein Files Transparency Act. They argued that the failure to provide a complete, unredacted disclosure by the legal deadline was a deliberate breach of the legislative mandate.
And the implication being that the DOJ was weaponizing its own archival function.
Exactly. That is the crux of the partisan debate here. Critics charged that the DOJ was strategically weaponizing the release, selectively damaging political rivals, like former President Clinton, by releasing these highly compromising images, while at the same time shielding the sitting president through procedural delays and these heavy strategic redactions on materials related to his own involvement.
It's just a powerful illustration of the politicization of that function.
It is. It shows the intense politicization of the executive branch's archiving functions. And it basically ensures the partisan temperature stays dangerously high heading into the new year.
It's a striking case of legislative pressure just hitting a wall of executive control and political calculation. Okay, let's move from that internal conflict to a direct external challenge from the judiciary. You mentioned a critical procedural defeat for the administration at the Supreme Court on that same day, December 19th.
Yes, this was a quiet but potentially epoch-making check on executive power, specifically regarding the independence of the federal workforce. The case is Margolin v. National Association of Immigration Judges, and the Supreme Court handed the administration a procedural loss by denying their request for a stay.
For our learner audience, what was the specific action taken by the Supreme Court, docketed as number 25A662?
So the court simply denied the Trump administration's request for a stay. What that means is that the highly intrusive and critical order that was issued by the lower court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, is now allowed to proceed. The executive branch basically failed to convince the Supreme Court that the investigation ordered by the lower court posed irreparable harm to the government.
Okay, let's start at the beginning of the Margolin case. What was the core legal dispute that the immigration judges brought in the first place?
The case started as a First Amendment challenge to a gag rule that was imposed by the Executive Office for Immigration Review, the EOIR. This rule prohibited federal immigration judges from speaking publicly about immigration policy, about judicial independence, even about their own agency, even if they were speaking in a personal, non-official capacity.
And the Judges Association challenged this as a free speech violation.
Right. The National Association of Immigration Judges, the NAIJ, challenged it as a violation of free speech.
But the case quickly grew from a simple First Amendment challenge into this profound constitutional battle over how the entire federal bureaucracy functions. How did that leap happen?
The leap happened when the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals got involved. The district court had initially dismissed the case, but the Fourth Circuit reversed that decision. And they ordered an extraordinary, sweeping investigation into a crucial systemic question involving the Civil Service Reform Act, or CSRA.
And what was that staggering question that the Fourth Circuit ordered them to investigate?
The Fourth Circuit ordered discovery into whether the president's actions, specifically the politically motivated firing of independent agency heads, like the chair of the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB, and the special counsel, whether those actions had effectively destroyed the integrity and the functional capacity of the administrative grievance process.
Okay, we need to slow down here, because for a lot of listeners, the MSPB and the CSRA are pretty abstract concepts. Can you explain why the Merit Systems Protection Board is supposed to be politically insulated, and what happens if it can't function? Because this is the heart of the issue.
You should think of the federal workforce as having a crucial internal judiciary. That's the MSPB. The CSRA was created to protect federal employees from being fired for political reasons, to make sure the bureaucracy operates on merit and professionalism, not partisan loyalty. The MSPB is the body that hears appeals from federal employees about adverse personnel actions, wrongful termination, demotion, retaliation. It's their internal court system.
And to work, it has to be independent.
Exactly. To function independently, the board needs a quorum of politically appointed members.
And what if those members get fired or their replacements are blocked? And that effectively neuters the board.
If the board doesn't have a quorum, or if its investigative functions are compromised, the whole process just stalls. Employees can't exhaust their administrative remedies. In effect, their internal court system is closed for business. So the Fourth Circuit is asking if the executive branch, in its pursuit of this unitary executive theory.
The idea that the president has total control over the executive branch.
Right, that idea. The court is asking if, in pursuit of that theory, the administration has systematically broken the very checks and balances that Congress designed to protect career civil servants.
And the Supreme Court's denial of the stay means this investigation into the executive's internal machinery can now go forward. What is the potential legal earthquake if the lower court finds that the administrative grievance process is actually broken?
And that is the systemic impact. I mean, if the lower court concludes that the internal mechanisms for protecting civil servants, the deep state checks that the administration so often criticizes, have been neutered or functionally destroyed, it will set an immediate massive precedent. Federal employees all across the country could then argue that they're no longer required to exhaust those administrative channels.
Which has been a long-standing legal requirement.
Right. And they could take their grievances, like wrongful termination or retaliation claims, directly to federal court.
That would bypass the executive branch's control entirely.
It would fundamentally redefine the balance of power. It shifts the oversight of federal personnel from the executive's internal agencies to the federal judiciary. The outcome of Margolin could decide who truly manages the federal workforce in the future, the politically appointed White House or politically insulated courts. This is the single most important legal check on the unitary executive theory we've seen in years. And the Supreme Court's procedural denial means that fight is now on.
A truly profound legal development buried under that barrage of executive actions. Okay, so we've covered the executive's domestic policy and the judiciary's counterweight. Let's pivot now to global volatility and the legislative branch. Sam, tell us about the kinetic action the U.S. military took in Syria on that same day.
The government's actions weren't just confined to Washington. While all of this was unfolding, the administration authorized and executed a large-scale series of retaliatory airstrikes in central Syria on December 19th. This was a very clear demonstration of force projection overseas.
What was the specific military objective and, crucially, the casus belli, the justification for such a large response?
The objective was to target Islamic State ISIS infrastructure and known weapons depots. The action was framed as direct and immediate retaliation for a specific ambush attack that happened earlier in the week. And that ambush tragically killed two U.S. service members and an American interpreter.
What was the scope of this retaliation? Was this a surgical operation?
Far from it. A U.S. official described the operation as large scale, confirming that the military struck approximately 70 distinct targets across the region.
70 targets?
70. This scale is massive. And it signals a very clear political and military message.
That level of kinetic response, it seems designed to send a message that's both military and maybe political, interrupting the holiday news cycle back home. What does this signal about the administration's military doctrine in the Middle East?
it signals a very robust adherence to a doctrine of disproportionate retaliation. By launching a military response of this magnitude 70 targets in reaction to a single ambush that killed three Americans, the administration is deliberately trying to reestablish a severe level of deterrence against insurgent groups.
The message is pretty clear.
The message to adversaries is simple. Any attack on U.S. personnel will be met with overwhelming, costly, and perhaps non-proportional force.
And the political paradox here is just stunning. Despite all the America First rhetoric that often favors global withdrawal and avoiding forever wars, this action demonstrates a continued aggressive commitment to kinetic engagement in the Middle East when U.S. troops are threatened.
It is the defining contradiction of this administration's foreign policy. They maintain significant strike capacity and the clear political will to use it decisively to protect U.S. forces, even while they're simultaneously criticizing the cost and entanglement of those regional commitments. The long-term cost, both financial and diplomatic, of sticking to this doctrine of disproportionate response, that remains a very open question, especially given the rhetoric favoring isolationism.
Shifting back to Washington, Congress was rushing to clear its legislative docket before the holiday recess. The sheer quantity of bills passed in the Senate that day suggests a concerted political strategy to bypass the typical partisan gridlock. What was the focus, and how did they move all this legislation so quickly?
The focus was overwhelmingly on Veterans Affairs VA reform, and the mechanism was key. They passed a whole raft of legislation by unanimous consent.
Meaning no one objected?
Exactly. No senator objected.
Right.
And that's the only way to move large numbers of bills quickly right before recess, because it bypasses all the lengthy debate and procedural holds. The fact that all these VA reforms passed signals that both parties found politically safe ground in supporting veterans, even while other major issues are totally gridlocked.
So let's move beyond the dry bill titles and talk about the necessity of these reforms. Why was Congress so focused on improving accountability and access to veteran care?
These bills are a direct response to years of scandals and persistent functional failures within the VA system, particularly around wait times and their modernization efforts. Take S-607, the Improving Veteran Access to Care Act. This mandates that the VA secretary establish a plan to make sure healthcare appointments are fully scheduled.
Meaning a confirmed booking.
A confirmed booking, rather than just languishing as a mere request in the system somewhere.
And that fully scheduled language, that's a direct legislative response to the VA's notorious history of, you know, using manipulated metrics to report artificially low wait times.
Absolutely. And furthermore, S-607 explicitly ties this scheduling mandate to the VA's troubled electronic health record modernization program. It's basically Congress demanding that this multi-billion-dollar technology overhaul has to actually deliver the intended benefit of reducing veteran wait times and administrative uncertainty.
Accountability seems to be the focus of the next bill, S-787, the VetPAC Act of 2025. What mechanism does this create for external oversight?
The VetPAC Act is a crucial structural reform. It creates the Independent Veterans Health Administration Policy Advisory Commission, or VetPAC. This body is explicitly modeled after MedPAC, which is the nonpartisan commission that advises Congress on Medicare policy.
So it's an outside watchdog.
It is. VetPAC is tasked with providing external, expert review of VHA operations, finances, and efficiency, and then reporting its findings objectively back to Congress. It's an essential layer of independent accountability, designed to check the agency's performance without partisan interference.
And beyond the veterans themselves, we saw legislation expanding benefits to surviving military families. Tell us about S-1204, the Gold Star and Surviving Spouse Career Services Act.
This is a significant expansion of existing benefits. It extends eligibility for the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program, which provides essential career counseling and employment help, to include Gold Star spouses.
These are individuals whose spouses died while serving.
Right. This action recognizes the profound ongoing sacrifice made by surviving families, and it grants them access to federal career counseling and employment services that were previously reserved strictly for veterans.
That is an important acknowledgement of their sacrifice. And what about accessibility for disabled veterans?
That was addressed by S-1383, the Veterans Accessibility Advisory Committee Act. This bill establishes a specialized committee that's tasked with conducting a thorough nationwide audit of all VA facilities. And this audit will look at both the physical accessibility of the buildings and the programmatic accessibility, meaning are the administrative processes themselves easy to navigate for veterans with mobility or other specific disabilities.
So it removes both physical and bureaucratic barriers.
That's cool.
Finally, the Senate pushed through a major human rights landmark relating to trafficking victims.
Yes, H.R. 4323, the Trafficking Survivors Relief Act. The Senate passed this landmark bill that allows victims of human trafficking to have certain federal convictions vacated and their arrests expunged. This is vital because it legally recognizes that many trafficking victims are coerced into committing federal crimes, things like drug distribution or prostitution. And those legal barriers shouldn't stop them from being able to find rehabilitation, housing, or future employment.
It's a crucial piece of restorative justice legislation.
It really is.
So the Senate basically used this unanimous consent mechanism strategically to clear a massive and generally non-controversial set of deliverables that benefit a highly respected group of veterans and their families right before heading home for the recess.
It was a classic pre-holiday legislative strategy. You deliver these politically potent bipartisan wins that contrast sharply with a gridlock that's dominating the rest of the news cycle. They get to clean the slate and claim productivity going into the new year.
We've covered everything from international trade war threats to domestic bureaucratic independence. Let's wrap up the day by looking at how the president used the bully pulpit to control the narrative around all of these high-impact actions.
So the narrative synthesis all happened at a campaign-style rally held that evening in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And this is not a coincidence.
Yeah.
Rocky Mount is a key battleground district, which signals a highly focused and very early start to the 2026 midterm cycle, using these Friday actions as the campaign platform.
What was the key economic messaging that the president was pushing at that rally?
He framed the entire day as a success story of his governance. He presented the massive Trump RX expansion, along with recent stock market highs and dropping inflation figures, as evidence of an economic golden age that was achieved through tough negotiation. And crucially, he explicitly linked the success of the Trump RX deals to the threat of tariffs.
Positioning himself as the deal maker.
Exactly. The deal maker who uses tough trade policy to force these large, often foreign corporations to serve the American consumer.
So the populist deliverables from Friday became the foundation of his political message for the next cycle.
Precisely. And he used the rally to engage in intense partisan rhetoric attacking Democrat elites and focusing heavily on consolidating his base. He dismissed major political rivals and really focused the political energy on protecting the Republican House majority by campaigning in key swing districts well ahead of the 2026 election.
And finally, before we synthesize, let's just note the administrative order that formalized the extended holiday break for the federal workforce.
Right. An executive order was signed just before the 19th, formalizing the closure of all non-essential executive departments and agencies on Wednesday, December 24th and Friday, December 26th. It just granted federal employees an extended holiday break.
Which is a pretty common administrative gesture ahead of the holidays.
Correct. Standard exceptions apply. Of course, essential offices needed for national security, defense, or public need, like the military, the intelligence community, the TSA, they all remain operational.
Sam, this was just an astonishing day of synchronized government action.
Yeah.
Let's synthesize the long-term implications for our listener, for the learner.
December 19, 2025 was a true case study in executive innovation meeting institutional friction. We saw the administration use trade policy as a domestic regulatory tool with Trump RX, use safety regulations as a labor and sovereignty enforcement tool with the DOT rail action, and engage in this highly politicized archival control with the Epstein files.
All while simultaneously facing this critical constitutional check from the Supreme Court in the Margolin case.
Right.
Let's go back to the two most profound long-term implications, the so what for our audience. First, what does the Trump RX deal guarantee for the economic future of healthcare?
It guarantees the creation of a fundamentally permanent two-tiered pharmaceutical market. The administration has cemented a governmental role in pricing, using trade authority as the lever. So you now have a government-negotiated public option that's accessible through Trump RX, offering deeply discounted drugs, versus a potentially much more expensive private market. This forces an irreversible structural change on how manufacturers and PBMs have to do business going forward. It ensures the government is now a persistent major player in drug pricing.
And on the legal side, particularly with the separation of powers and the future of the federal workforce.
The Margolin ruling ensures a protracted and highly bitter legal battle over agency independence. The Supreme Court's decision to let lower courts investigate whether the administrative grievance process, the MSPB, has been destroyed, that fundamentally challenges the unitary executive principle. the outcome of this case by potentially allowing federal workers to bypass their agencies and appeal directly to the judiciary could ultimately redefine the scope of federal employee protections and the constitutional limits of presidential control over the federal bureaucracy.
So the courts are essentially taking over the job of policing the political integrity of the executive branch itself.
That's what it looks like.
It is a phenomenal demonstration of how innovative, synchronized executive action pushes against its legal and political limits, often bypassing the legislative branch entirely to achieve its goals. For our learner today, you now have the exhaustive detail on how the levers of power were pulled on one remarkable Friday in December.
And here's a final provocative thought to consider, connecting the domestic actions back to the global. We discussed the massive scale of those retaliatory strikes in Syria hitting 70 distinct targets. We have to ask, what is the true long-term cost, both financial and diplomatic, of adhering to a doctrine of disproportionate response in an age of rhetoric that otherwise favors global withdrawal? That aggressive kinetic action is a costly, complex policy decision that stands in sharp contrast to the isolationist message being delivered at home, and its necessity and sustainability are vital points for continued exploration.
A critical question for the geopolitical future. Thank you, Sam, for the deep dive.
My pleasure. Thank you.